Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
Hey, Sex with Simmery folks. You need to get real excited because August 20th through 24th, Philly Podcast Festival is back. This is the second time. Last year was amazing. Thank you to everybody who came out. And there are a ton of locally grown podcasts talking about all sorts of different topics. And you can come hang out at Tattooed Moms, which is on South Street in Philadelphia. Watch a live show. It's going to be amazing. A lot of people have giveaways. It'll be just awesome. So there's going to be cool shows there, including Sex with Timmery. We're going to talk about some sex, I imagine. There's also going to be like Unspoiled, Story Shuffle, Action Phase, Talking Nerdy, The Pincushion, Going to Hell, Stark Raven Mad, a bunch of other shows. There's so many. If you want the full lineup, if you want the schedule, you want more information, you go to phillypodfest.com and you're going to find out all sorts of stuff there. So get excited and we look forward to hanging out with you.
Welcome to Sex with Timmery. This is Dr. Timmery, and today is a reader question day. I'm going to be answering some questions that people have sent in. In case you didn't know, you can absolutely send me your questions. I may not be able to get to them super quickly, and I apologize if there's a delay, if I've gotten swamped with other stuff, but I want to hear from you, and I want to be able to help you out whenever possible, and I certainly will maintain anonymity and never tell any of your identifying information to anybody. So if you have questions, you can send them in to sexwithtimmery@gmail.com. You can also hit me up on the Facebooks, facebook.com/sexwithtimmery. You can direct message me there as well. You can hit me up on Twitter. It's a little bit harder to send questions that way, but my handle is @Timmery_Lee, T-I-M-A-R-E-E _L-E-I-G-H. So today's questions are going to range in topic from HPV to vaginismus, inability to orgasm, timed ejaculations, how mental health affects sexual relationships, stuff that is pretty common, stuff that will have a lot of relevance to everybody outside of the people who wrote the questions. So even if it isn't necessarily relevant to you today, it's good stuff to know because it'll probably come up in your life with someone you care about or a friend, you know, comes to you with a question, or just so that you understand what's going on elsewhere in the world, so you get a little bit of context of how your life relates to other people's. So great questions, and as I mentioned, you can send yours in as well. You can also submit your images for the Not Safe for Work gallery. I do take submissions from readers and listeners. If it's just you in the picture, of course, obviously you're welcome to send it in. If there's anybody else in the picture, make sure you have that they're okay before you send it in. So let's get it popping with our first reader question. So our first question has to do with a little bit of sexual health information and as far as what information is getting out there to people and what is not. So this comes from a reader who says, a male friend of mine, he's 25, recently experienced the panicked Googling that comes with any illness. He was pretty convinced he had genital warts and took to the internet to confirm it. Dangerous, I know. Before finding a doctor and making an appointment. In doing so, he came across enough articles about Gardasil in men to take notice. Apparently, the CDC has been recommending boys, in addition to girls and young women, get the vaccine since 2012? ! That's great. That's awesome. His question is, why has no doctor he's been to in the last 2 years mentioned anything? Gardasil's website cites a CDC recommendation for boys and girls ages 11 and 12 to be vaccinated. He's 25, still within the overall 9 to 26 range, and obviously was 2 years ago. Why isn't this more visible? Is it more uncommon for males on the older end of the range to get vaccinated? Males who I would assume are at a high risk of contracting HPV. I understand the vaccine may or may not have affected this scenario. Basically, what the heck? It's an excellent question. It's a very good question. So just to back up and give a little bit of context. So HPV is an incredibly common sexually transmitted infection. Incredibly common. Estimates range from 50 to 75% of all sexually active adults, that is, if you have any sort of sexual contact with any other person, that somewhere between 50 and 75% of people will at some point get HPV. Now, there are 15 different strains, and they do different things. Some cause warts, some are the type that can lead to cancer, and there are some strains that are more common than others. And among the strains that are less virulent, especially, your body can clear them. Your immune system might take care of them without you ever knowing anything about it. But you don't know. You don't know that you had it necessarily, and you don't know that you cleared it, and you don't know that you're infected, and you don't know that you could infect other people, which makes it sort of a sticky situation and why we encourage safer sex behaviors. So HPV is also skin-to-skin contact. You can get it even if you are wearing a condom. And, you know, that's the other issue. It's also a very common issue because of oral sex. HPV is actually the number one cause of throat cancer now. The challenge is we have a vaccine, Gardasil, as the question writer mentioned, that will take care of four of the strains. If you get the vaccine, all three shots in a sequence before you come in contact with it. So if you've already come in contact with it, it's not going to do anything for you. And the reason the CDC only recommends Gardasil up to the age of 26 is twofold. One is that it's just not approved for any older than that, and you just can't tell people to get something if there hasn't been rigorous testing saying that you'll be okay. I mean, there's already enough concern about vaccines as it is without just like telling people randomly to get them. The other issue is that by the time you're 26, most people have just come in contact with them anyway. And so that's why we want to get people vaccinated when they are but boys and girls. That is why 11 to 12 is recommended, because we want them to have time for the immune response to develop so that when they become sexually active, they are already protected. So again, HPV, 15 different strains, four of them are protected by Gardasil. Different strains do different things, incredibly common. And we're talking about a major source of cervical cancer. Among boys, it can be a source of both anal and penile cancers, and of course, the number one cause of throat cancer, above smoking and other risk factors. HPV gets extra exciting because the screening process is crazy. So for women, the best screening process is getting your regular pap smear, but that's going to show you the specific precancerous things, and you might need to get treatment. You might need to have the warts frozen off. You might need to have cervical tissue removed or something of that nature to treat the infection. Men do not generally get screened for HPV in any way. What it would require is for a swab to be taken down the urethra, and very few men are open to doing that just because it sounds awful, and most doctors aren't going to suggest it. And there's basically no screening for the throat cancer that can come from HPV. The people who are screened for mouth and throat cancers are generally smokers, and there's, you know, therefore not a lot of impetus to go check in people's mouths who are not smokers, even though they might be at actually a higher risk of throat cancer from having contracted this. And when Gardasil first came out, there was a lot of controversy about getting anybody vaccinated because, again, we find that it's much more useful if you have this vaccination before you're sexually active. Because if you're an adult, again, you've probably come in contact with it. You probably have. And in fact, there's a recent study that came out about HPV can absolutely be spread by sex toys as well. So even if you didn't physically touch somebody, you can still have the possibility of transmission. There was a few other things in that study that also compared different cleaning products that can be used on sex toys to prevent transmission. But as always, just a good reminder, if you're going to use sex toys on your body and someone else's body, or, you know, just any multiple bodies, that you want to put condoms over them if that's applicable, if they're a penetrative thing, to use dental dams whenever possible, and to make sure that, you know, you use the same sort of protections you would for skin-to-skin contact. So when the Gardasil vaccine came out, there was a lot of controversy because there are the folks who just don't like vaccinations in general. There are the folks who don't like the idea of a vaccine that relates to sexual health because they just don't want to think about their daughters having sex, and they don't want to give their daughters the idea that they are safe and therefore can go have sex. Plenty of research has found that, you know, these sort of things, specifically the Gardasil vaccine, does not increase sexual activity among young girls. It does not encourage them to behave more promiscuously or have a higher number of partners or start earlier onset of sexuality with other people. There's absolutely no validity to that claim. It's just a knee-jerk reaction that if I get my daughter this vaccine, she'll then go be a little hua. And it's not really borne out by the evidence. In reality, it can be a really great starting point for conversations about sexuality and about safer sex and about your expectations for your kids, about what is okay, what your values are, what you would like for them to do, what you hope that they know about your belief system, that sort of thing. So it can be a really great idea for just jumping off point for that sort of conversation. But Gardasil has been approved for girls for longer because it was tested on girls first and it got approval for girls first. The reason was that girls are disproportionately affected by cancers caused by HPV. Cervical cancer is a much more significant problem for girls than penile or anal cancers are for boys. And when we first were learning all this stuff, we didn't know about the throat cancer connection to the degree that we are now confirmed. So, interestingly enough, even though most HPV is spread by heterosexual contact, which means that it requires a boy to have an infection to give a girl in the first place, we still were focusing all the prevention entirely on girls, which is just sort of the nature of how we do sexual health stuff. As you've probably noticed, you know, girls are the ones that ultimately are going to end up having to do most birth control things. It's just the onus that we put sexuality into the responsibility of girls. And of course, if girls are the ones that are suffering disproportionately from the cancer, we want them to be treated more directly. However, it does make 100% sense to address the vector through which they come in contact, which is sex with boys and boys who have HPV. So we want to prevent the boys from having HPV as well. However, less than 1% of boys are currently vaccinated, although, as you mentioned, it has been available and it has been recommended by the CDC for multiple years now. And the American Academy of Pediatrics updated their guidelines just this month to take it from a thing that they're in favor of to a thing they actually just recommend. It is part of their recommended vaccinations for boys. The Gardasil vaccination is now recommended. But you are correct that there has not been nearly as much hoopla about this. And there's a few different reasons why. One is that maybe boys' sexuality isn't quite as controversial, and so there are fewer parents freaking out about it. There's also still the issue that a lot of parents just feel like their boys are just fine and they're going to be okay, and they're not as worried because the threat of the penile cancer rate is just so much less insidious than the cervical cancer rates, so they're less concerned. There's that perception of risk for their boys that makes parents less concerned about it. And then there are also people who actually have this question about whether this is a cost-effective measure. Because the Gardasil vaccine is three shots, which are over $100 each, so it ends up usually being about $360 to get, including, you know, on top of whatever else might have to pay for doctor's visits, that sort of thing. Some people are like, is this really a cost-effective vaccine to have given the likelihood of, you know, an actual cancer being caused by this? I would say yes. That's my personal opinion. But some folks are like, well, I mean, whatever. It's really ultimately the girl's problem, and I'm not going to take care of my son's health on the basis of the girls that he's going to have sex with, which I have questions about that whole thought process. But the vaccine covers only four, so you're not actually covered for the other nine strains, which is part of the question why some people wonder if it's necessarily the best bet. But those are the four most virulent strains, the four most dangerous strains, the ones that can do the most damage. So I absolutely recommend that the parents of young boys have them get this vaccine. The earlier, the better. Obviously, your friend is still within the age range where it is possible to get it, but it is going to do him a lot less good at this point. So to get specifically to this guy who is now 25, on the verge of 26, could still get his shots in time. It's very possible. But realistically, the amount of good it's going to do him is a lot less than if he had gotten it, you know, years and years and years ago. For the folks who are on the other side of 26, when the vaccines came out in the first place, they're just kind of like, oh, all right, I guess there I am. So your best bet then is actually just the safer sex behaviors that you already know about, that you want to use condoms, you want to use dental dams. And if you can get regular cancer screenings, then certainly going for that as well. Females should get regular pap smears. Definitely ask your doctor about doing an oral screening for a throat cancer. If you have symptoms of genital warts, definitely just go to the doctor. I know he wanted to do the internet search first and not have to deal with all that, but the internet's not going to be able to treat anything for you. So maybe just go to the doctor. But this is an important question, just so that everybody knows that this is an option for boys. It is available. It is highly recommended. It is not that big of a deal. It's not that hard to get. And it is on now the recommended list, according to the American Academy of Pediatricians. Now we are going to move to another question. This is a different topic entirely. So this is more related to relationship-y stuff, and specifically about penetrative sex. So here is the situation. My partner and I have been dating just over 2 years. She moved in with my mother and me a half a year ago, and we will be moving out on our own within the week. It should be an exciting time for both of us, but I am not finding a lot of enthusiasm about it. We've never had penetrative vaginal sex. We've attempted it, but the result was so traumatic for her that I discontinued immediately. And this was after about a half an hour of erogenous activity. So generally, our sexual interaction consists of frottage, which is rubbing, mutual masturbation, and oral sex. Of the two of us, I am much more open to experimentation. I would be content to leave it at that, except we seem to be growing increasingly averse to any sexual contact with each other. We seem to be falling into a mean-spirited pattern, and as a male, I feel a biological compulsion to experience orgasm at least once or twice a week. I would prefer a much higher rate, given our living situation. I lack the privacy and time to masturbate. I also tend to feel depressed after masturbation and consider sexual intimacy a priority in a romantic relationship. Similarly, I feel uncomfortable accepting sexual gratification when I'm not allowed to return it. Sorry. The act of gratifying my partner is as or more important to me than experiencing my own orgasm. She, meanwhile, seems to invite any excuse for distraction when sexual intimacy arises and is actively and increasingly averse to accepting oral sex from me. I have been quietly researching vaginismus as a possible cause for her reservations against physical intimacy. And lately, we seem to be drifting further and further out of sync with each other in all respects. Every conversation comes back to our sex life, which I hate. I feel that sex could serve as a healing tool for a relationship and that we could work on other areas if we simply regain some ground with each other in that way. So this is a little bit, of a heartbreaking situation, and I definitely feel for both of you. It does sound quite frankly like vaginismus is an issue here. That was immediately what sprang to my mind from the very beginning. And vaginismus is a condition, for those who are not familiar, where penetrative sex is made basically impossible because the vaginal opening is so tightened, is so squeezed, involuntarily. This is not a matter of just like having a tight vagina. This is that, it's an anxiety response that will be completely out of control of the woman, and she will be unable to get anything inside of her. Sometimes it can, mean that tampons can't be used, she can't get her own finger there, that sort of thing. And generally, vaginismus is a psychological response to trauma and anxiety. And you mentioned that you are a little bit more open to experimentation than she is. And I am not at all surprised to hear that, because vaginismus tends to strike people who are very, very anxious about sexuality, often those who have experienced a significant amount of trauma around it, perhaps a lot of sexual guilt from their parents, perhaps actual sexual abuse. And it is not easy to fix. However, it is totally possible to fix. It's going to require a lot of patience on both of your parts and a lot of commitment and due diligence. The process of treating vaginismus is going to require therapy. Generally speaking, that's also part of the recommended process. And whenever possible, go to a person who is an actual sex therapist who can deal with this holistically, and they know what they're talking about in terms of these sexual issues. It's also going to be a long process of using dilators. You're going to start out with very, very, very small, very, very, very small ones. And she is probably going to do this in her own time, maybe like take a nice relaxing bath or doing something that just super chills her out. And then she's going to set the mood and she's going to work on dilating herself, dilating the vaginal opening with a very, very small thing that's, you know, smaller than a pinky. And this is a process that takes a different amount of time for different people. But ultimately, over the course of many weeks, she would work up to larger and larger dilators that would eventually be the size of like a index finger, maybe a couple index fingers. And, you know, you can be involved for pieces of this activity. And eventually it leads up to involvement from the partner and using your fingers and your penis. This requires patience on both of your sides, and I know that that can be very challenging when you're both having a lot of emotional feelings about this, because up to this point, there's just been all this toxicity building up from this lack of reciprocity, from this lack of your needs being met. She's probably feeling very guilty for not fulfilling your needs. She's probably feeling a lot of self-judgment for not being, you know, a sexual person in a world that very much encourages that. She knows that you're upset, and she knows that she's the source of your stress, and she probably doesn't feel super great about this either. You're feeling the resentment that you described in terms of depression from lack of sex and lack of affirmation and from lack of that type of intimacy. That's completely understandable. Both of you are in completely understandable positions. And the solution going forward is to work together. This cannot be done by either, you know, guilting or arguing or anything like that. This is a patient process that involves a shared interest in the mutual outcome of, you know, her feeling better about this and her physically being able to do this. This is an involuntary response, vaginismus is. So, you know, guilting, arguing, those sort of things are not going to be helpful because that's not really what's causing it. So it's going to be a dual process of therapy and also dilators. But the good news is that it is possible to do. And it sounds like you're going to have a little bit more time and you're going to have a little bit more space in your new place in order to facilitate this. So it's totally doable. And I wish you the absolute best of luck with it. So for this particular question writer, how is he going to address the situation? It's difficult because he's not the one who's experiencing the physical problem. I'm assuming this sounds like vaginismus to me, because if the issue is that penetration is not possible, it seems like that is what's spiraling forward and making her not want to have oral sex, making her not want to do other things. I mean, obviously, one really significant option is to just expand your ideas of sexuality. And it sounds like they're doing other things as well, mutual masturbation, rubbing against each other, that sort of thing. And for some reason, there is a level of importance in vaginal intercourse to this question writer. Now, there's a couple different ways we can look at this. One is the fact that, you know, plenty of people delay sexual intercourse for a variety of reasons and still find their sexual relationships to be satisfying. It sounds like this is not a satisfying relationship despite the fact that intercourse is not happening. And it sounds like it's just sort of a lack of communication in sexuality. So this goes to the fact that this problem is likely not just about wanting to put a penis in a vagina specifically, but having more to do with what this represents. So for a lot of folks, the difficulty that arises when one partner wants to have sex and the other one does not, or their frequency levels are different, or one person is experiencing sexual pain or some kind of dysfunction like erection difficulty, orgasmic difficulty, it ends up escalating because the person who's having some sort of physical problem or having some sort of psychological barrier, there's that much more pressure on the situation because they know that this is hurting their partner. And so they know that it's damaging their relationship and they're not able to express physical affection to each other, to experience intimacy together in a sexual, physical sense. So, you know, if a couple's getting along just fine and they're literally on the face just, you know, able to deal with it very openly, they can find other ways around it. It's very possible to have a very, very satisfying relationship engaging in lots of different types of sexual behavior other than penis and vagina intercourse. This is absolutely true for a lot of people. However, if what if it's representative of is the partner's lack of concern for this being an ongoing problem, if it's more representative of the fact that the partner is shrinking back and not trying to address this and not talking about this openly and being unable to communicate about what this means, then the question writer, for instance, might be feeling rejected. He might not be feeling attractive to her. He might not be feeling connected to her because they're not communicating honestly. So sex isn't just getting off, but it's also what it represents. And so we need to address these issues in a very honest way. And sometimes that can be jarring. Sometimes that can be scary to be like straight up with your partner and just say like, this is what I need. And it's not usually, you know, the frequency really isn't usually the issue for people. It's what that frequency represents. It's like availability. It has to do with spontaneity. It has to do with just affirmation, confirmation that your relationship is strong, that you are attracted to each other, that you are connected, those sort of things. Sometimes it's about getting off, but most of the time this is actually about something deeper. So addressing this issue with your partner is going to mean honest searching, getting yourself into a conversation where you're being very real and mutually vulnerable and thinking about deeper, what is it this represents to you? What is the fear that you have? And taking ownership of the fear that you have, not putting it on your partner and saying, when you do this, blah, da, 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 blah. Instead, it's about, because we are having sex in this very specific way and we're having it less and less often, and because we're unable to do specific things that I would like to do, I feel this way. The fact that I don't have time to myself makes me feel this way. Rather than putting it on your partner and making it a blame situation where you then are going to just go back and forth with that, take ownership of your own feelings and the underlying desires that you have and the needs that are not being met. And that's the only way you're going to have a productive conversation. That's the only way you'll be able to bring up that you think that this might be a treatable situation. And then you can start down the road to actually fixing things. So this is going to bring us actually to our next question, which is sort of related because it's also about one partner's physical experience and how it affects the relationship and its sexual components. So this is written about male orgasmic control and focused ejaculation exercises. That's the general topic here. So this is writing in about a friend of mine is a 45-year-old African-American male, healthy, decent shape, tall, slim, well endowed. He can achieve flip-flopping excitable erections, but when he gets hard, he's not able to focus and relax to achieve a timely orgasm. So he starts to get a bit flaccid, then sort of erect, all the while staying stimulated, while having harder and harder time reaching climax. It is necessitating more manual stipulation for this female partner, and it can take a long time and become mechanical and dull. So she is suggesting that he starts practicing, either alone or with her, autoerotic release techniques when he is very hard, where the focus is on coming within 5 minutes. And then as he's able to do that, build on it, see if he can make an erection last for 20 minutes, etc. She indicates that she has worked in the sex industry, so she finds timed sex to be a great exercise in mutually pleasurable voluntary releases, showing self-control and discipline, along with setting clear time boundaries. Especially with busy schedules, being able to utilize 20 or 30 minutes of free time should result in mutual satisfaction. If the exercise works, I suggested, then attempt to build to porn-style romping around the room. I'm curious what that romping looks like. That's cute. Okay. Evidently, he finds the idea to be a form of premature ejaculation, which he thinks is unhealthy, and he's opposed to these timed ejaculation exercises. She says since he is not ejaculating at all right now, simply waxing and waning through erections, she really feels that these are a good idea. So, a lot of going on in this question. the first issue is that I'm not entirely certain I understand what is happening with him, although it sounds like he's able to get but not necessarily maintain an erection and is at this point anorgasmic. So there are multiple types of orgasmic disorders, either situational, where it only happens under certain situations, like perhaps just partnered sex, or perhaps when you're drunk, or perhaps in a specific, you know, like it's a stressful situation, you think you're going to get caught, or you're cheating, or specifically it's late at night, like whatever. If it's caused by situation, it's situational. There's primary and secondary types of orgasmic disorders as well. Is it something that has always been the case? Have you always had difficulty with this, or is this something that has developed later? The easier to treat situations are the ones that are situational and the ones that have developed later. The hardest orgasmic disorders to treat are the ones that have happened the whole lifespan and happen under every circumstance. So for instance, a person who is unable to orgasm through any means, never has been able to, including during masturbation, would be looking at a little bit more work than somebody in another situation. So I don't know what happens when this guy is alone and jerking off. I don't know how that's going for him, because if that's fine, then what we have is a secondary situation and it's situational. If he didn't used to have this problem and now does, that's what makes it secondary. If this has been his whole life, in fact, he has this issue with erections, then we're probably looking at something much more physical, and time exercises aren't going to do anything. They're probably just going to be very frustrating. We have to figure out what is the situation that either prompted this to start in the first place, or what are the specific circumstances under which this happens. Timed exercises, fine. It's generally something you would want to use for someone who actually has premature ejaculation. Generally speaking, premature ejaculation can be treated quite effectively through exercises where you stimulate yourself up to a certain point and then pull back that level of stimulation. And then you're going to go back into it, and you're going to pull back, and you're going to go back into it and pull back to be able to develop a degree of control over your level of arousal. It can be very effective for someone who is not able to last for as long as they want to, who is perhaps unable to have a satisfactory sexual experience because they come too quickly. It is not, however, necessarily something that is I would recommend to speed somebody up who's having erection difficulties. If someone is, let's say, to use the term, lasting too long, I'm not sure that you actually would want to masturbate away from that. In the case of somebody who is able to orgasm, but it just takes them longer than is convenient, or someone who takes a really long time to get off, and in that meantime, their partner, you know, starts to feel sexual pain, or it becomes just terribly inconvenient because they just literally don't have that amount of time to devote to sexual activity, that sort of thing. You could do things to speed it up. There are certainly medicational issues that could come into play with that. Is medicational a word? I don't know. Medication issues that can come into play. Certainly somebody who has been drinking or certain drugs can definitely delay orgasm significantly. So cutting that out or reducing that could be a piece. Also just making sure that you're able to focus and get consistent and steady stimulation. If there's too much happening, if there's too many things going on, you have to like keep a leg up real high and then also at the same time balance yourself, and also at the same time like the kids are crying. Like, it's just going to be harder. But what I'm actually getting from this question is that it's actually an erection difficulty. So we would need to know a lot more about this guy's situation in terms of his lifelong relationship with his erections. The fact that he's well endowed is interesting, because the larger a penis expands to be, the more blood required to do that, therefore the more blood flow you're going to need. And if there's any sort of issue with that, if we're needing some sort of drug like a Cialis or a, you know, a Viagra to help with a blood flow issue, that might actually be all you really need to solve this problem. If this is a psychological situation, then we're going to need to talk about the dynamic between the question writer and this guy. It sounds like she has a very specific idea of how she would like her sex to go, and this is not going that way. And this is not satisfying to her. And some of this could be, you know, then because she has this additional experience in the field of sex work, then she feels like, oh, it's my professional responsibility to fix this for him because I know a lot about this and therefore this is my job, this is my responsibility. And that can really change a dynamic in a relationship when one person thinks that they are responsible for the sexual relationship of the entire couple, especially if you take that particular type of ownership of it where you feel like you should know more or you should be in charge of or giving directions on. And so that might create an interesting power dynamic where you're telling someone how their body should be working and how they should use it. And that is not necessarily the best way to build a relationship of mutual satisfaction. So in this instance specifically, I would need a lot more information to really be helpful in terms of solutions. But I'm actually not sure that the timed masturbation thing really is going to solve much for someone who's got an erection difficulty. My first instinct is always to check physical things and to try out something like a Cialis or a Viagra to see if blood flow is ultimately the issue. Also making sure that the psychological situation is chill, that y'all are okay with the fact that sometimes sex does not involve a hard dick, and that maybe you come up with other solutions. Maybe other solutions would include more oral, maybe it comes up with some toys, you know, maybe a little bit of pressure is taken off of him by having a dildo on hand, so that if you're looking specifically to be penetrated by something shaped like a dick, that you can have that happen and he's not gonna have to necessarily be the one that provides it. You got a few other ways that you can deal with this. So that sort of brings us back to the conversation about the last question. So in both of these scenarios, we have one member who is also not the person writing the question, who has some sort of physical situation that is making the sexuality of the couple not work to the exact specifications or desires of the person who's writing the question. It's an understandable frustration when you have a specific desire and you have the expectation that normal, healthy functioning should involve that, and that is not happening, and your partner isn't doing things to fix it. That can be very frustrating because it's like, why do you not care about our sexual relationship enough to do something to fix this? However, putting that type of pressure on the situation is very rarely helpful and can be a real impediment to getting the person to actually care about wanting to fix it, because then they might start to feel a little bit resentful about how, why is this solely my fault? They may not feel like they're getting heard about what the functional partner is asking for. There's obviously another side to this story, and I'm not going to get that at all in this situation. So the thing that I would encourage is just lots and lots of conversation about, why specifically is this a problem? Why is this an issue? What is it about this particular physical impairment, this physical situation that is so problematic? Because, I mean, let's be perfectly honest, in both of these scenarios, we have this vaginismus issue, we have this issue with erections. There are lots of people who have sex where there aren't any vaginas. There are lots of people who have sex where there aren't any hard dicks, and still they make it work. And so we have to ask, what is it that they are doing differently? How are they approaching sexuality in a more holistic way of, let's see what we can do with what we have, rather than let's make what we have fit a particular model? So this goes to those great things that I've posted before from Al Vernacchio, his idea of sex being like a pizza, where rather than being goal-oriented, where there's a specific order that you have to go in and a specific place you have to get, instead, you decide what you're looking for and what your partner is looking for, and you order it in a collaborative way, and you decide, do we want more pizza? I could still definitely handle some more. Or like, I'm good. That's about all I really needed. I'm pretty set now. And then it also goes to Karen B.K. Chan's model that she has talked about, the jam model session, the jam session model of two musicians who are jamming together and approaching sex from this collaborative, like, so what instruments do we have with us today? What can we do with that? And thinking about sex as that collaborative sort of idea where you're coming together to see what will make you both happy, rather than following a strict script. And on this relationship navigation front, I have one more question. It has to do with mental health. It has to do with polyamory and other models outside of monogamy. And it has to do with being a person in the real world as an adult. And it's rough. So this is a situation that I think a lot of people will be able to identify with, even though the individual circumstances might not be specific. So this couple has had a very long, hard, stressful winter, as many of us did. Benzodiazepine withdrawals as a piece, suicidal fantasies, and there's difficulty with both partners finding employment, and they're looking for a new place to live as their lease is ending. And they're having difficulty doing this sort of basic living stuff due to the level of depression that they're both experiencing. She adds in, what I want for him to understand in his heart is that me having sex with other people is in no way a replacement of him. So part of what she wrote about was that she would like to be able to have sex with other people, specifically women, because she identifies as bisexual and this is a opposite sex relationship and she is missing that other piece. She goes on to say that he's an insecure little thing who's been cheated on and can't deal with the idea. He does understand that it's an issue of sexual orientation, but still cannot come to terms with it. He's seeing a therapist. I need him to talk to her about his sexual frustrations, but I know it's not my place. She goes on to say that, you know, she's spent a fair amount of her life depressed and can totally understand what that's like. But I feel that as a grown man, he should be able to table his panic attacks, take some deep breaths, get the shit done, and then stare at the wall as long as he likes. I will make him soup and bring it to him when I get off work. I will support and nourish him, but we need to have a place to live and a way to pay the rent first. So it goes on a little bit more from there about how they're living basically as roommates. The sex has been very infrequent. They're both sort of like placing the responsibility on the other person, and that's kind of where they are now. And that is a not uncommon scenario. I have heard this story, variations on it, many, many, many times, where things are tough in life in general. It's hard to feel a strong and powerful sense of identity when you are having difficulty with that sort of grown-up shit where you have to deal with where you're living and your job and those sort of things. Depression is a libido killer. Best case scenario, a lot of folks, you know, try to medicate themselves with sexuality, often in compulsive and not super healthy ways. So it's not really best case scenario. That's just more sex case scenario. And it sounds like these are folks for whom depression and sexuality are intrinsically going to be connected and correlated in that when they are depressed, they don't feel like initiating. They don't feel like being loving, giving, collaborative partners who are going to get off just on getting each other off. It sounds like they both have a lot of needs that are not being met, a lot of emotional support that they feel is not being provided by the other person. And I get that the question writer understands the concept of depression, but if you get the concept of depression, I think you understand why it can be so debilitating to do the most basic of functions. That is the nature of depression. It doesn't make any logical sense. It's not about your bootstraps. It's about not being able to drag yourself across the room to get the mail. And realistically, a therapist alone is not probably going to be enough. We're looking probably at a situation that requires some psychiatric medications to get out of this funk, even if just for a while, to just reset your clock. This is a real tough scenario. This is very real. This is a thing that happens to a lot of people when they're worn down from having a kid that's brand new and the amount of time and effort and lack of sleep that goes into that. And it can be debilitating. And lack of sleep and this sort of like cloudy funk can make it harder to really see from the bigger perspective how your own behavior would be different if you were in a better mood, and how it's really easy to put blame on other people because you can't fathom functioning any more than you already are. It's already so incredibly hard to be a person when you are depressed. What I absolutely recommend to both of these people is having much more in terms of dealing with the depression before you can even address the sexual issues. So that's going to be a lot more attention paid to doing whatever it is that's going to make you feel healthier and happier. I'm a huge proponent of natural methods, getting lots of sunshine, getting a very nutritious diet, something that's not going to weigh you down. So a lot, taking out all the sugars, taking out all the caffeines and the alcohols and that sort of thing. Definitely promoting the idea of, you know, fresh air, lots of exercise, the tremendous impact of going outdoors and getting exercise, even just temporarily on your mood. That's not going to solve long-term clinical depression, but it is a thing that you can do that might make you feel better. And I recommend doing all of the things that will make you feel better. Because when you get yourself together, you can be a better partner. You can be a much more loving person to everybody because you have that energy to give. And when you're just trying to survive, it is impossible. No matter how much you might love someone, to just be like, oh, we are going to fucking do this thing right now, and I'm going to just shower you with all the kisses that you would like to have, or whatever you'd like to shower them with. So in this situation, we're talking very practical solutions. We're talking about asking for help from whoever can help you with finding an apartment, asking for help with whoever can help you find a job, getting those things out of the way first. The sex is important, but I don't think that fixing the sex will fix the other things. I don't know if it'll work in that order. Maybe. But if it is, then you're going to have to be the question writer. The person who's bothered is going to have to be the one who just goes above and beyond and just does all of the crazy romantic things that are going to initiate some sort of romantic intimate scenario. So not necessarily like forcing someone to have, like, we're going to be romantic right now. But, you know, just showering with affection and being better to each other than you have to be because you love each other and you want to be available to each other. So in the meantime, I think that those things need to be sorted out before we can even get to this, like, sleeping with other people piece. Because that right now sounds to me like a distraction from the question at hand. Like, yeah, that is also a legitimate concern. Being a bisexual person in a monogamous relationship can be very challenging, and figuring out how you're going to negotiate that. But I think that's a tertiary issue at this point. I think you have a couple other things in front of you that are more proximal. So I wish you absolute best of luck. I wish best of luck to everybody who wrote in questions. These are all fantastic, and I feel like a lot of us can empathize with these things, or we know someone who's experienced a very similar thing. So these are common, it's not weird, and they're very real. And so I'm grateful to everybody who wrote in questions today, or who, whenever we write them in. And again, I invite you to send your questions to sexwithtimory@gmail.com and facebook.com/sexwithtimory. And they don't always have to be heavy. They can be totally light. They can be like, yo, what's an epididymis? Whatever. You know, I'm happy to answer those too. So thank you very much for listening and have a great day.
Hey, Sex with Timory folks. You need to get real excited because August 20th through 24th, Philly Podcast Festival is back. This is the second time. Last year was amazing. Thank you to everybody who came out. And there are a ton of locally grown podcasts talking about all sorts of different topics. And you can come hang out at Tattooed Moms, which is on South Street in Philadelphia. Watch a live show. It's going to be amazing. A lot of people have giveaways. It'll be just awesome. So there's going to be cool shows there, including Sex with Timory. We're going to talk about some sex, I imagine. There's also going to be, like, Unspoiled, Story Shuffle, Action Phase, Talkin' Nerdy, The Pincushion, Going to Hell, Stark Raven Mad, a bunch of other shows. There's so many. If you want the full lineup, if you want the schedule, you want more information, you go to phillypodfest.com, and you're going to find out all sorts of stuff there. So get excited, and we look forward to hanging out with you. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timmeri, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimmeri.com, Sex with Timmeri on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timmeri_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.